Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to my show. I am Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and this is a place I like to bring topics I find that others are experiencing and may wish for a frank discussion of tips and solutions to improve and inspire their lives. I know, that was a really big mouthful. So what that really means is you see something and you say, I really wish I could find something else out about that. This is the place to hear it. So we have a full range of topics that I talk about on my shows, from health and death to dating and cookies, and even to incontinence. I think we can cover all the gamuts. If I can see it or feel it or touch it and want to know more about it, you'll hear about it on these shows. I grew up by asking why in all areas of my life, you know, and it's something I still live by today. My guests and I talk about a topic in casual conversation so you, the listener, can feel like you're across the table from us with a coffee or tea. I welcome you, to listeners, and I hope to answer some of your questions as I speak with the host. I'm sorry, the guest. I just put myself down. Anyway, if you would like to call into the show, I welcome you to dial 424-258-9318. And then it's important that you push 1 to be in the host queue so I will be able to recognize your number that you have called in. And if you'd like to speak, we'd be more than happy to hear what you have to say, and possibly we can give you a little more insight. I would also encourage you to follow my show page, and you will know what I'm touch on next and when my next show will be. So now it's time to share with you and to start the show, and welcome. I begin every show, and you know, when I talk about a product that I have found to improve the quality of life, and I do this every show, different products, different times. So today, I'm sharing with you about memory, what we can remember about names and places and what we had for lunch yesterday even. The company is Quincy Bioscience, and the product is called Prevagen Professional. You know, the reason I started taking it was after several stressful life events in the past few years. My kids would always say to me, "You're not paying attention to me. Why didn't you write that down? I don't know what's going on. Why aren't you listening?" So I started taking 1 capsule of Prevagen Professional, 40 milligrams. They also have a 10 milligram if you're interested. I only take 1 capsule a day, and it's really improved my memory. The product Prevagen Professional, it has a very unique ingredient to help improve short-term memory and word recall. Now, this ingredient, everybody says, I have that vitamin and this one, and I got a collection, and they're all kind of in there. This ingredient, 99.9%, I can tell you, is not in your products. And it does not interfere with any other supplements or medications, and that's very important because how many times do you change what you're taking or what you're not taking, or you get new medications or change the dosages? You start on this, you can stay on this, and you're good to go. And it has no common allergens, and that's very important. Because if you look on the bottle of some of the supplements these days, they say they're manufactured in a company where the product may be exposed to soy or nuts or dairy or wheat or gluten or whatever else they want to put on there. I know for myself, I don't do soy, and I am allergic to seafood, so this is very important for me. And research has shown it can reduce brain cell loss up to 50%. You know, I think that's a great margin and worth repeating. It can reduce brain cell loss up to 50%. That doesn't mean wait until you're 50% brain cell loss already and then hope that you're going to take this and you're going to get all that back. So if you're in your 40s and 50s, this is probably a product you should be looking at before you start to have real issues. I would encourage you to give them a call and ask them how Prevagen Professional may help you. Their phone number is 888 895-6463. They have tons of clinical studies and a lot of reports on how Provigen Professional has helped others. You really just need to ask them for help. I know it's worked for me, and I wanted to share this with you. If you call them and you have any questions whatsoever, just say you've heard it on the radio show and you'd like to speak to somebody who could walk you through about the product and know more about it so you can make an informed choice. Again, their telephone number is 888-895-6463. So today my guest is Carl David, and we will be talking about the aftermath of suicide. Carl has written a book called Battlefield: How My Family Survived Suicide. And he wanted to talk in the book about the trauma, the suicide the family member leaves behind, you know, on the survivors. What happens? You know, we definitely want to hit on the points. If you are having any issues whatsoever with this in your family, Carl also is equipped to give you some 800 numbers on this show. So, Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Jeanette. I appreciate it. It's an honor to be here with you.
Thank you so much for being with us. Can you tell us a little bit about how this even started or why you're even here talking about this?
I lost my dad in 1973 at the tender age of 58. And I also lost a brother when I was 16 to suicide. He was 22. And my dad only lived 8 years after that, understandably. I think that it ate him up from the inside out as best he could get back to life. He did. But I knew that someday, when I had kids, they would never really know the greatness of my father. And originally, I started to write this book as homage to him. He was my hero. He was really an incredible human being. And I just wanted to memorialize him so everybody else who didn't know him would know him, you know, at least vicariously through me. So I started to write this book, and as the book evolved, of course, the story of my brother's taking his life came in one of the chapters, and it took a long time to write it. I mean, I would put it down because it was too painful. I'd come back to it months later, and the loss of my father was one thing. The loss of my brother was far more traumatic, if you can even compare to disasters like that. But I knew that this had to be done, and my wife would tell me, you know, I'm reading this, but you're intellectualizing. I'm not feeling it. If it's too difficult, just put it away and don't do it. And I said, no, I have to do this. I'll go back and I'll do it the right way and I'll feel it. And, you know, of course, I was resistant to doing that initially. And I understood where she was coming from, and I knew in my heart that it was intellectual and it was lacking the emotional component that it needed to, you know, to become alive. So I went back and I redid this thing, and I lived through all the pain again, and it was tough. I had these tear-stained pages that came to reality, you know, as I was writing them. And then after I wrote the one chapter, at least initially, about my brother, my wife, Arlen, said to me, she said, this is great. This is the best chapter. I'm really feeling it. You know, I feel like I was there. So then, I knew the book would be a success. And, of course, it took me years to find a publisher. Well, it doesn't matter. It took decades to write this thing. But I had to write it. I had to go back and relive it, and I knew that I had one shot to get this thing right, and I finally found the publisher who said they loved it and they wanted to publish it for me, just wanted me to do one thing. And I said, what's that? She said, well, we want you to rewrite it movie style. I said, okay, great. I said, what's movie style? So she said, we want dialogue. We want you to bring your characters to life. We want you to show the story, not tell it. So they gave me a great editor, and in 6 weeks I rewrote the whole book, and I knew what it had been missing before, and it really was the dialogue. It came to life, and the characters were alive, and everyone who had read it afterward, including myself, felt the presence of everyone in the book. So, you know, that said, I had to do this. It was in my craw. I mean, I had this notion to take the darkest days of my life and do something to benefit others with them. I was paying it forward, if you will, because I had this experience, and I kept it to myself. It wouldn't have done anybody any good. And I knew that if I had reached out with the book and by doing interviews like this one, that if even one person heard it and knew of someone who was in that kind of final desperate pain and would talk to them, you know, or even change their mind and realize that there's tomorrow and that there's help for them and that life is not as hopeless as it seems at that given moment, I might save a life. I might save a lot of lives. I may never know, but it really doesn't matter. You know, it's kind of casting that stone on the water and creating the ripple and letting it traverse the waters until it reaches somebody.
So every few minutes, Carl, if you could give out one or two of those 800 numbers that you have, because if anyone is listening at any time and you need some help, there is help available, and we would highly encourage you, even if you have the smallest inkling that something is amiss in your family or with yourself, make the phone call. They don't write down who you are, where you live, and they're going to come and get you and all that other stuff. All they're going to do is listen and direct you to services that will help you. So do you have that number?
I do. There are a lot of numbers, but the ones that come to mind immediately are the National Hope Line Network, and their number is the easiest one. It's 1-800-SUICIDE. And there's another one, which is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-TALK. And these are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, anonymous, and they are there just to help you if you've got a problem. If you have someone else you want to talk to, whether it's a clergy person, if it's a bartender, a friend, a family member, even a stranger. I mean, this is a world we're living in now that's very complicated. It's very high pressured. But you have to remember that there's help out there. This isn't the 1960s anymore where, you know, mental stress and situations that are causing such undue pressure are looked down upon. I mean, this is an era where there's help out there and everybody's out there. We're all connected, you know. So this, as big a world as it is, it's a real small world. And there are lots of us out there who have had this kind of experience who are there to share and to help, you know. I mean, there's no shame in that anymore. I mean, it's a shame. The stigma of suicide kept it vibrant for so long that the act would thrive because no one would talk about it. They would turn their head the other way, and you know, it was kind of like one of these ugly acts that nobody wanted to acknowledge. You know, somebody committed suicide, and said, "Oh, that's horrible, it's ugly," but nobody would talk about it. Well,
I find out also too that it also depends upon the area in which you live, because I do live here in New Orleans, and the mental hospitals are all closing. Now, if you have a mental issue in this state, there are only one place for you to go, and that would be to jail if you did not have insurance or a way to pay to be able to get services in a private place. Then that is the true harsh reality of it. So you can take things from a great extreme to another extreme. Great, I can get help. Great, I can't get help. What do I do now? But also to recognize if you see someone else that may need help, and those services aren't available, to try to help them find other services that are available. Because I can tell you, in the past 3 weeks, there have been several violent, violent crimes in this state, actually just in this area, in the New Orleans area, where if mental health services have been in force, in effect, and there was a place for these people to go, those potentially may not have occurred, because they were not able to get their medications, and they had a few lapses in their treatment, and when the hospital closed, there was nowhere to go. So we are encouraging, Carl and I both, anyone listening, if you need help, call the 800 numbers. Whether there's someone in your area or not, there is still help, because things can escalate to a great deal, and you know, we just don't want to see any undue harm to anyone. So, again, Carl, those numbers?
Okay. 1-800-SUICIDE is the first one that comes to mind because it's so easy. And the other one is 1-800-273-TALK. Now, there are others. There are lots of other
That's a start.
Suicide hotlines in local areas. These are national. But they're generally, you know, if you're in a big city, There are other local organizations. There's one near us in the Northeast called Contact, and they're trained to help people, you know, because if you can take that 10-minute window and talk to somebody, you can most likely talk them out of it, or at least give them the chance to think about it before they do it and perhaps change their mind.
Well, with your brother, can you give us a short insight into how old he was, and did anyone see it or not see it, and how old were you at the time, and what really, in your mind looking back now on it, do you think had potentially predisposed that?
That's a tough question because we never really had any answers. We didn't see it coming. There were no hints, no signs, you know, afterward. It was just complete blindsided our family. And, I mean, they're, you know, you never know quite what's going on in someone's mind. And my brother was very happy-go-lucky kind of guy, at least we thought he was. Overtly he was. Maybe inside he had these issues raging. I don't know what they were. I knew that he was in the reserve unit, which was about to go to Vietnam, and the media was portraying these guys coming back in body bags and limbless. Yes. I mean, the horrors of war.
This
which
was
is
in
enough
the 60s and 70s.
It was the 60s. Yeah, it was 1965. And, you know, it wasn't there yet that our troops were really coming back and the war was turning. Well, it didn't happen until Nixon's second term. However, I don't know if that was enough to do it. I'm, you know, it's one possibility. Other than that, we have no clue. In all candor, it doesn't matter because whatever the reason was, you know, it's too late. I wish that he had been able to talk to somebody, anybody, no matter what it was that was bothering him. It's fixable, you know. I mean, it's not the end of the world.
Right.
And it really doesn't matter what it is. So, you know, somebody who keeps that kind of torment inside doesn't have a chance to let it out. And, you know, once you let it out, it's not so bad. It's just that when you're all alone and you're struggling with something, it just seems insurmountable. I was 16. He was 22. I had no clue. None of us did.
We have a caller, so let's take a call and see what they'd like to share with us. Hello, caller. Hello. Hello. Guess they're not there.
Well.
We'll leave that open in case they come back on. So, but what I could also ask, too, is what did you find, you know, may have occurred just before or just after? I mean, like, was it at his home? Was it somewhere else? In other words, like, your pattern or your story may help others say, maybe I should notice that, maybe I shouldn't, you know?
Well, you know, there were no real indications. The only thing that was out of character was, and we all lived at home, he didn't come home that night.
Mm.
And my father found him in the gallery the next morning. And that was, you know, which is something I can't even imagine, that kind of horror. But there were no, you know, there were no telltale signs. There was nothing. I mean, you know, we did hear later, he went to night school. He was at Temple University night school.
Right.
And we did hear something that he had made, someone had made allusion to the fact that in class he was in, someone was in a class with him at that night school. They had made allusion or questioned about suicide. Some, you know, I don't know what the question was. So, you know, at that point, we had no idea, and I don't know if it was that night or if it was the night before. This was after the fact that we had, you know, gotten that little snippet. But, you know, it's a shame we hadn't heard something earlier.
Right.
We may have been able to, you know, to have forestalled it or just completely prevented it.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, I mean, there was no indication, no notes. There was nothing, no signs. There was no conversation. There was no overt fear, except for the idea of his unit going to Vietnam. But, you know, I don't know. It's, you know, the whole thing is not, it doesn't generally happen when someone's in a rational state of mind. So who knows?
Let's see if this caller is on the line. With the phone number 504 for the area code, are you on the line?
Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I'm calling because I'm curious. I have not read the book yet. And given it was a different period of time, what was the, I guess this question goes to David, what was your family's immediate response to this? Was it just shock and dismay, or did it affect any arrangements for, like, final arrangements? I mean, how did that affect, you know, again, it being a different time period?
Well, we the first reaction was shock and anger and just disbelief, which was a big factor. You know, we rallied together because we had our family and our friends, and at a time like that, you need everybody, every area of support that you can garner. And we were lucky. You know, we had good family around us, and we had our friends and the community. And, you know, we tried to put the pieces together as best we could. I mean, funeral arrangements happened, you know, relatively quickly, and it was the only way we could move on from there. You don't get over it, you know, ever.
No.
You just learn to live with it as best you can. So
right.
We took it not even day by day, but hour by hour, you know. And we had a very close family. We were what I call an idyllic 1960s family. We had a good life together. We all got along. We were all happy. At least I thought we were, you know, to that point. And, you know, we just pulled together and stuck together and fought like hell to get back to life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, life goes on with you or without you. And, you know, you never stop mourning. However, you have to get back to life. And you've got to live on not just for yourselves, but for the person you've lost.
Right, right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, you know what I find, too, is that, as we have said about time differences, like the 60s, it was not good to put something like that in the newspaper. But now it's very commonplace to put something like that in the newspaper or to say that. And a long time ago, everybody would be distance themselves from you, versus now they tend to come closer to you. So that is a huge awakening of people, do you not think?
I agree completely. You know, it took me a week or two to go back to school after my brother took his life. And, you know, when I went back to school, I'd be walking the hallways and I would feel these impenetrable stares looking at me, you know, and going right through me like, he's the one whose brother just killed himself, you know. And it was kind of
right.
Like a very strange badge of negativity.
Right.
And I couldn't look at them, you know. And I also didn't know how much of it was real or how much of it was in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the perception was there, but it may not have actually been factual. Although I'm sure that some of it was, because in that day and age, as you said, in the 1960s, this was something you didn't talk about. I mean, this
absolutely
was, you know,
I
a
remember.
Stigma of shame, you know,
mm-hmm.
that went along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons, you know, that I've reached out with the book and my experience is to raise awareness, because this is an issue that, like anything else, any other ailment, any other disease, it's going to take education and awareness and people banding together and caring to fight it, to thwart this thing, because otherwise it goes unchecked.
But
you know
what, Ilsa? If you look at your book, right, and your book is now in this era now, this decade, and we look back and we say, let's take some other people that had this happen to them in the 60s and 70s in their families, and now these people are in their 50s and 60s, I would think this book would be a lifesaver to many people who have been carrying that badge of, you know, disgrace for so long and still won't talk about it. How many people? I mean, I grew up in the Northeast. It was very good and okay and whatever other phrases you wanted to put on it, that if you died from alcoholism, okay, yeah, so what? You know? But if it was anything with suicide, it was like you almost had to move out of the city, you know?
Yeah. It was a crime.
But those right. And now those people, those who were children at that, let's say if you were a child like you were in the 60s and 70s, and have to still carry that with you your entire life because you didn't want to open up, this book would not only open up and save some young people, but it would also save those older folks who have been hiding it for so long.
Yeah, absolutely. For a case in point, a new client came into our gallery. And I should have mentioned, I'm in the art business. We're four generations old. We're in Philadelphia, the David Art Gallery. And we specialize in American and European paintings, drawings, and watercolors, and sculptures. That said, just to give you a little background on who I am, and I can elaborate on that in a minute. But a new client came in just a week ago, and we had a real connection. This fellow's about my age. I'm 63. He may be a year or two older or younger. And we started to talk, and you know, he asked me, what do you do besides being an art dealer? He's a physician. So I said, I'm a writer. I've written a couple books. I've got another one in the works. I've written a lot of articles that have gotten published. And he was really curious about the book. And he said, what's it called? And I said, Bader Field, How My Family Survived Suicide. I said, I lost a brother to suicide when I was 16. He was 22. And he opened up and told me that he had lost a brother to suicide when he was 32 or 35, and his brother was 10 years older. And he said, I've never been able to talk about it until very recently.
Right.
So, you know, there's a perfect example of allowing people the privilege, the luxury, if you will, of just letting this thing out, you know, so they don't have to be burdened by it. And, you know, it's not, as I said before, it's not like you ever get over it. But there's an unsung club of people like us, you know, who've been through it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just never know. I mean, you talk about 6 degrees of separation. Well, every time you turn around, someone knows of someone or someone has had someone in their family who's taken their life. And you know, I talked to somebody else the other day, and his grandmother took her life, and then the aunt took her life. You know, it's just,
right.
I mean, it's unbelievable how rampant it really is. And, you know, statistically, more than a million people a year take their life worldwide. And in this country, about 38,000 so far in 2011. I mean, the statistics in 2012 aren't even in yet. But unfortunately, they're greater than they were in 2011. Every year, the number climbs. And that doesn't count the attempts. I mean, my God, the attempts are, like, you know, 20 times more than the actual event. It's scary.
Well, you know, now that people don't have medical insurance, a lot of times, you know, once they get that diagnosis, they're like, I'm done. You know, I'm not going to be whatever picture I have conjured up in my mind I would look like or feel or experience. I don't want anything of it, and this is the easy way out.
This is true. This is true. I mean, the system's got to kind of change.
And it really has increased because, you know, families not having the money or homes being gone and cars and all those other material things, you know?
I know.
If you're not really strong in who you are, who your heart and soul is, you know, with or without stuff around you, it's very difficult. And I can tell you from experience with Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, you know, when everybody lost everything, they went to these other areas and they said, oh, you know, it's great. And they started collecting all of this stuff, you know. I'm going to feel better because everybody's going to give to me. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get a house, a car, and a TV, and a double-wide refrigerator, and the whole deal.
Right.
But when it came down to it, they still were not happy. They wanted to come back here. And when they came back here, it was because they felt uncomfortable in this place they were. So they themselves were not sure who they were in the whole entire process. Because really, if you're confident enough about yourself, you'll be okay anywhere, right?
Right.
Or so it's supposed to be.
Right.
You know, we all would like to believe. But, you know, a lot of those people, when they came back, just couldn't function again. And it was very high, the incident. I mean, physicians, I mean, why would you think that a doctor would actually do something like that? And that many did. It was very sheltered. It was not known. You know, if you searched for it, you could find it. But there are many, many physicians, people in the healthcare fields, mothers, fathers, kids. after a devastating, you know, disaster, people just don't do well when their paradigm of what it is gone. So, I mean, I think when you write the book, you write about your experience, but I think we also need to focus on what is your paradigm around you and how much do you really hold? In other words, are you putting that, you know, golden peg in there and saying, this is what I am, this is who I am, and, you know, don't shift that anywhere or else I'll be in, you know, in an area of discomfort. So is discomfort where people get in trouble?
I think in part they do. I think when your very being is shaken to the core for whatever reason, whether it's a Katrina, if it's a military vision of something that, you know, these guys coming back from the war, for instance, have this post-traumatic stress that is, I don't know how they live with it. I mean, you know, one thing the military does not do enough of is counseling and helping these guys, not only in the field, but when they come back in
right.
the military, there's one suicide a day. You know, and that, and again, that doesn't count the ones that that they don't know about. It's let me throw out a couple of suicide numbers again while we're on.
Yes, please.
The National Hope Line Network, which is 1-800-SUICIDE. There's also the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-TALK. There are a couple of others. There's a Youth America hotline, which is counseling by teens for teens, and that's 1-877-YOUTH-LINE, 1-877-YOUTH-LINE. Now, there's also the Trevor Project, which is a big organization. They deal in crisis intervention and suicide prevention. Their number is 1-866-488-7386. And there are all kinds of issues that people face today, whether it's a transgender issue, lesbian, gay, bisexual, racial, you know, stature. I mean, you know, there's so many reasons that people are persecuted. Bullying, you know, there's another issue that's got to stop. I mean, this is crazy. I wish kids would just stand up and fight for themselves, but they get so overwhelmed with the groups of people that attack them emotionally and sometimes physically. And, you know, it's just, it's terrible. And it really needs to change. People need to wake up and stop doing that to other people. It's just,
you know,
it's not right.
I really find I have four children. They're 21 to 31 right now. But when they were all in high school, every single one has had one or two instances where they came home and would say something about, oh, so-and-so had, you know, took their life yesterday or, you know, every single one. And I can tell you it's not been a regional thing because we lived in Pennsylvania, we lived in Florida, we lived in Arizona, and we lived in California. So it didn't matter about the stuff. So I think that's a point I like to drive home. Stuff doesn't matter. It matters who you are inside. So
right.
When we are asking you and giving you our listeners these 800 numbers, we would ask you to focus on that. Say right out front, you know, I am having this issue. This is my problem, how I feel. You know, say it from your heart. Say it from what's coming inside. And if you have someone in your family that has the same issues, that would be the first word I would ask is what is inside? Because it doesn't matter about your car, your house, or your money, or your book bag, or all this. Granted, those are the outside version of what it looks like, but the inside version is you, and that is where you will find that you will either be able to go on with life or not. So you really need to look inside yourself and decide what is important to you. Is it important that your mother comes home every day and sits down, and even if she just sits on the side of the couch with you every day so you'll feel better and not be afraid in the house? Maybe that's something that has to happen. Maybe because you're afraid, you know, you just tend to walk around and create an ambiance around you where you might get into trouble, you know. So
yeah.
Maybe parents and family and friends or even neighbors could look at what is going on with these family members and kids or even adults because, as I've just said, even if physicians who know everything in the world about how to save lives can't even save themselves, we need to look inside. So if we could give a few tips on what we might look for. Are we looking for, you know, shoes untied or, you know, what's simple and what isn't? what would you look for?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I was just thinking about something while you were talking about that. One of the other reasons I had written this book, and I'm sorry to digress here, but I think it's important. I had the most extraordinary family life that anybody could ever ask for. Short as it was rich and it was wonderful. And, you know, I take that experience with me. It doesn't matter when, where, or if. It's part of me. And one of the other reasons I had written the book initially was to show people who did not have as fortunate a childhood as did I that they are capable of turning the situation around. And instead of taking that out on their kids, if they had abusive parents, if they had no parents, that they, you know, when it's their turn to get up to the plate, they can break that chain of negativity and be a great father and give to their kids and give them something that they didn't have so they've got a better foundation. I mean, there's just as much joy in giving that, maybe more, you know, than having received it. Of course, I was lucky I did receive it, but someone who has not is possibly going to be very bitter and you know, take it out on, on the next generation. So, I wrote the book for that as well. And I guess that the grander purpose, twofold, you know, in helping to save lives, and what you touched on before, is helping people who've gone through this experience to know that we do go on, we survive, we live, and you know, and we shouldn't feel guilty about living. We have a life to live, and you know, it's ours, and there's so much joy, and the planet is such a fabulous place with all its stuff, you know, and all its negativity and all the horrors. It's still a great place to live, and it's a great place to be, and every day you wake up is a gift, and, you know, that's something I don't think anybody should throw away. Some people don't get that gift. You know, they don't live long enough, whether they're suffering from an early childhood illness or whatever. I mean, but if you, you know, if you're lucky enough to get up every day, do something good with your life, you know, and help somebody else. Because truly, between family, friends, and love, that's it. I mean, that's the best thing there is here.
Well, you know, I can say this from experience. I grew up in a very destructive background. But for some reason, I could, you know how they always say, sit down and picture yourself, you know, even in the face of destruction. So I would always do that, and I would see myself as a little girl, and I would spin around a circle, and there would be all glitter around me on the top. And that's how I lived my life, is that I could always go to that place and know that you were safe and that you were cared for and loved, because you could think, could that be God? Could that be someone else? Could that be the place you're in? It could be any of those little things. But all those little things added up together can really help keep you safe, to keep you moving forward. You know, so when you're feeling all of that, how can they create a space in themselves to feel safe or to ask, tell someone they're not safe?
Right. That's a tough question. I mean, you know, emotions are very complicated. And sometimes when you're in the depth of that kind of despair, darkness, it's very difficult to see past that and realize that there is something else out there, that, you know, tomorrow is another day. My grandfather used to say, you know, as bad as today might be, tomorrow is going to be better. And, you know, most times that's true. At least you have another shot at it. We get a redo every time we get up. So, you know, it's up to us in large part to make the best of it, and do whatever we can for ourselves and for others, you know, at the same time.
You know, I think it's very important, us as parents, or if when we see people around us. I recently babysat for a two-year-old, and she had a little temper tantrum and stuff, and I know she doesn't hear it often, and every chance I get, I would say, you are so beautiful, you are so glorious, and you are just a great person, you know, say these positive things. And it was about, I guess, 2 months ago for the last time I watched her. And when I got in the door, she repeated them back to me, and I thought, good. That's a good thing.
She heard.
So then that will start, because when she repeats them, she will eventually figure it out for herself. But when she repeats it, other people around her will hear that and say, that's full of whatever, or I don't understand that. But it will get the other people who don't understand it to start understanding themselves.
Right.
You know, I think it's sometimes you want to challenge someone else with a question, and they may get angry, but anger is sometimes a good provoking of someone, because it knows that they still have feeling. They're still in touch, you know.
True.
Maybe when you get no response and you just get complacency is maybe when you're in more danger, you know.
Yeah, that's not good. I mean, if no response is just that, if you can't evoke a response in somebody, or you don't respond to something and you're numb, or you're just
tuned out.
Yeah, tuned out. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to communicate. And, you know, that's one of these the benefits of these suicide hotlines, that they can actually talk to people, you know, and get them to talk and get them to spill their guts, if they will, you know, whether something is horrible that they've endured, or they're feeling lousy about themselves because they're not feeling they're not feeling very good about themselves, or they're inadequately.
There's no judgment on those phone calls. They don't know you from Adam.
Right.
There is absolutely no judgment whatsoever. If you told them, you know, something that no one in this wildest dreams could ever imagine, they'd be, okay, so where are we going next? So this
right.
is totally a non-judgment place.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it's not to be taken lightly. I mean, you know, if someone's in that kind of pain, they really need to reach out. If anybody's listening who's in that kind of pain, call somebody. You know, if you don't want to call a suicide hotline, call a priest, a rabbi, a bartender, you know, somebody that you can talk to, a friend, because there is somebody out there who will listen to you. And by the way, if anybody is out there who is aware that someone that they're close to is in this state of mind or crisis, don't leave them. You know, stay with them and get them the help. If you have to sit there with them and call 911 until somebody comes, you're better off to be a little bit overzealous and take the lead in this thing than have regret, because regret for this is a horrible thing to live with. You know, thinking I should have done something. I could have made a call. And,
there are no
you know,
mistakes. A cop is not going to reprimand you for making a call. Not going to happen.
No, you're better off, you know, knowing that you may have saved someone's life than not. You know, it doesn't take much effort.
You know, and I think we also need to be aware of elders, too, because when you go to older people are living a lot longer these days, and they're in their homes by themselves. And I don't know how many years, and when you're older and you don't feel well, that you really enjoy sitting in that chair by that window and never moving. So I do believe that, you know, a lot of elders these days are considering this option.
Yeah, I think they are. I think they've, you know, a lot of them have given up hope, and they're wheelchair bound, or they're paraplegic, and they're quadriplegic, and they feel like it's never going to get better.
Right.
You know, and I guess I understand that. I mean, there was a point where my wife and I were on the Dr. Oz show. We were in the audience, and because I'd written this book, they knew that I'd answered a reporter's query about suicide, my position on it, and I said I'm against it, and I do everything I can to reach out and prevent it.
Right.
And, you know, but I also understand if someone's in terminal pain like that, and they're, you know, late age in their life, and there's just no hope at every avenue of medical, you know, advice, and every medical avenue has been explored, and there just really is nothing left, and they're in agony, you know. I understood it, you know. But just to summarily throw one's life away, no. You know, to me, that's, you just don't do that, because who knows what's around the corner, you know? I mean, something great could be lurking tomorrow or tonight. And, you know, that's what these crisis centers do. They talk to you. And as I said before, if you have that 10-minute window, it's just sometimes enough time to change somebody's mind and make them choose life, not death.
And you know what? When you make that call, too, you don't have to be right going to commit suicide right then and there. You could just be contemplating it, or you could just say, my life is not working. Is this an option? So in other words, don't shy away and say, I'm not going to make the call because I'm not that bad. Or, you know, oh, I'm never going to get there. Or, well, it's really not that big of a deal. It's a big deal if it has entered your mind. If any of this has entered your mind, it's a big deal.
That's correct. It is a big deal, and it deserves help, and it deserves an answer, and it does not deserve judgment, and there won't be any judgment. That's the great thing about these organizations. You call them, and you're anonymous, or you don't have to be anonymous, either way. But even if you're not, they don't make any judgments about you. They're there to help you and to, you know, give you perspective. So they're basically buying time for you, you know, which is a great thing. And even if you're not on that final edge of desperation, as you said, you know, if you're just thinking about it or you're curious about it or you're wondering, like, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure, you know, I don't think I have anything to live for, and you're not planning on doing anything immediately, you know, these are great places to call because you need help. And this is something, suicide is something, by the way, that is way bigger than any one person can handle. Our family could never have gotten through it just on our own. It's a monster of an aftermath that we needed every bit of professional help that we could garner. I mean, I was lucky enough to have gone through a psychoanalysis, which, you know, after the expression of burying this in my gut for so many years, I was coming apart from the inside out, and I was lucky enough to get the help, and it saved my life.
Well, you know, we always talk about that, too, about the other people, and which is the focus of your book. And again, the name of your book is Baderfield, How My Family Survived Suicide. It's written by Carl David. So I'd encourage you to check out that book. It is listed, the reference, on the description of this show. So you'll be able to find that link there. You can just click on that, and you'll be able to purchase the book. But it is definitely about the people around, too. You know, if I am, let's say, a girlfriend and my boyfriend is saying something about suicide, I can call that number also. You know,
right.
I can be anonymous. I can find out some information for me. You know, they will direct me. So what if it's the right number or the wrong number? They will find where you can go from there, correct?
That's absolutely correct. And speaking of boyfriends and girlfriends, I mean, too many times today you hear about these teenage kids that are, you know, they're killing themselves because their boyfriend broke up with them or their girlfriend broke up with them. And, you know, it just, it happened here in Pennsylvania back in 2010. There were originally a suicide pact of three girls.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them jumped in front of a train because their boyfriends broke up with them. The third one, fortunately, changed her mind. And, I, you know, that night when I heard about it, I called Pat Shiraki, who's Channel 3 CBS News here in Philadelphia. And I said, Pat, you got to get me on the air to, you know, to talk about this. I said, this kind of behavior really needs to stop. The awareness needs to be out there. So the next day, she had a film crew come to the gallery, and I was the lead story on the news at 6 o'clock that night. And I got emails from people and phone calls thanking me. You know, for reaching out and for saying what I said and for sharing my experience so that it maybe would save someone else's life. So, you know, it's really important that the perspective, I mean, something like that is not a reason to take your life. I mean, that's, you know, that's totally wrong.
Well, you know, parents are so afraid to challenge their kids anymore because they say, oh, that's the teens, oh, that's puberty, or oh, this or that. You know, I can remember, you know, many times with my kids, I got right in their face, you know, what is wrong? What is going on with you? And one time when I did that, I'm only 5'4", and my son is 6'2". So the way I did that was I stood on a chair in front of him, and got eye to eye, and I said, what is going on with you? And, I mean, if that's what you need to do, that's what you need to do. And I really pushed parents, you know, in my practice that you need to be in their face. It doesn't matter. You're not there to be a girlfriend and put on a short skirt and run around with them and have all the girlfriends over. It doesn't work that way, you know. Get in their face, you know.
True.
Find that out.
It's true. You've got to be a responsible parent, and you have to be able to see things that they can't see. And you can be their friend, but you have to be their parent. You have to really kind of take the lead role. You know, speaking of which, people have asked me, you know, you have two kids. At what age did you tell them about your brother taking his life? And that was an issue that my wife and I talked about often as the kids were growing up, because we knew we wanted to be able to tell them. I didn't want them to hear it from someone else, but we knew it had to be at a time when they could kind of digest this, assimilate it, and not have it take off their life and you know, scare them to death.
Mm-hmm.
So when they were old enough, we felt they were old enough they could understand, we did tell them. And it was kind of almost as an insurance policy, so they would see the wrath of horror that an act like that leaves on their family,
right.
So
right.
that they would never do that, never consider it. And we always told them, mm-hmm. no matter what you do in your life, God forbid it's something really horrible, we're here for you, you know, and we'll always be here. You can always come and tell us whatever it is, no matter how bad it is, you know, we'll be there to help you and support you. So,
I think,
you know,
so many parents don't do that, though. You know, I have had experience with hundreds of parents who do not do that.
It's sad. I think it's really important to let your kids know that you're there for them and, you know, not let the nanny raise them, you know, but to be
right.
there. You know, I mean, that's another aspect of life. I mean, the dissolution of the family in today's society is scary, and that causes so many problems. I mean, these kids grow up without parents. They grow up in separate families. They grow up without siblings. And, you know, when the kids are not first and foremost as a priority, don't have them. You know, I mean, if you're not going
right.
to raise them, what's the point? I mean, it's the greatest gift life can ever give you, your children.
Yeah, it's so difficult, you know, being a parent when you have kids these days that are pretty, I guess we'll use the word violent. They are very aggressive. And if the parents had not been exposed to that or knew that before, and now they've got kids like that, that is an issue too. I mean, there was an instance here where a student had gone home to her mother for a vacation, and she shot the mother and went back to school.
Right.
It's like, oh, why?
God.
It's just because she didn't get what she wanted.
Wow.
And it's like, how do we get what we want, and how do we find those barriers, I'm sorry, those boundaries, you know, to... this is what I can do, and if we hit those, then we got a problem.
Right, right. Well, I think kids have to know from the get-go, you know, when you're raising them, that if you want something, you have to work for it. You have to earn it. It doesn't just come to you. You know, I mean, I had things when I was growing up, but it all came with responsibility. Things weren't just given to me, and we did the same thing with our kids. You know,
mm-hmm.
if they wanted a car, okay, you're going to have a car, but you're going to have to pay for it, or we'll split the payments with you, but... you know, if we take care of the insurance, you're going to have to make the car payments or vice versa, or we'll split it all.
Right.
It never came just gratuitously.
Right. You know, it's so funny, Elizabeth, about the car. My daughter's driving a car in her last year of college. She's just finishing up pre-med, and her car is, I think it's 14 years old now. And when she was 16, she just got her license, and she drove down the street, and she stopped because it was raining out and didn't hit the guy in front of her, but the guy behind her pushed her into the one in front, and she dented her bumper. So I said to her, she called me up, oh, call the insurance company to get a fix. I said, not happening. So we made her and her brother went to the junkyard, found an old car, got a bumper. She brought it home. She put it on her car, and it's a different color and everything. And do you know, this is now 8 years later. It's still there, and she just is, like, so appreciative of that.
That's,
you know,
great.
Because she learned the lessons in the process. So, you know, parents, how do you teach lessons and processes about being responsible for your own life? How can you do that?
You just have to do it. I mean, you have to, you know, unless you're the kind of parent who grew up with that kind of privilege and didn't get that perspective, you're going to hand the same thing to them that you got, nothing.
Right.
So, I mean, it's work, you know.
It's
you
work.
Want to walk a fine line. You want to give them things, but you don't want to spoil them. You know, you want them to know that they're loved unconditionally, but that, hey, these are the rules, and this is the way the world plays. It's not just our family, but when you get out in the real world, be prepared, because not everybody's going to be like we are, but you're going to have the foundation to go and do the right thing. And I think it's basically teaching them right from wrong. And
you know,
hoping
what,
they get it.
Yeah, no, and I think there's a lot of parents that are not potentially like us, but there's a lot of times where we, who do know of things, would share with other parents or share with other kids. I know there has been times where kids would come with my daughters or my sons to my house, and they would be in trouble with their parents. But we would talk about and work through that and get them back to their parent. So, you know, if there is, let's say, a child coming to your house that might seem like they're in trouble, don't just say, see you later, go home, or I don't want that kid in my house. You really need to be a responsible sub-parent, I would call it, and help that child right then and there.
Oh, absolutely. And there have been times that we've done that in our own home, you know, where they weren't sober enough to drive,
right,
you know, or
yeah.
if they were underage to drink, but they had a couple of drinks, and, you know, rather than have them get in the car, we'd say, hey, guys, you're staying here tonight. We'll talk
yeah.
to your parents tomorrow, you know, but
yeah.
you're going to be here, and you're going to be safe, and, you know, we'll explain what happened, and, you know, you're still going to have to pay the price, the consequences, but we'd rather have you safe than not at all. You're right. You can't just send them off and be irresponsible yeah. because who knows?
Right. I think spreading the message, I mean, granted, if you may not have the tools to help anyone who's thinking about suicide in your family or in your acquaintances or other people that are around you, if you don't have that capability to do that, you need to find someone to help that person, period. There is no ifs, ands, or buts. But if you also do have the way to be able to know something about it, you can help that person, direct them towards getting some help. In other words, don't anything you see, wake up. Don't live your life in blinders, as I have always said. You
right.
know, I get out there, be touchy-feely. You hear somebody say something that just goes, ooh, that doesn't sound right in my mind.
Yeah.
You know, turn around
yeah,
and ask that person something,
yeah.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Do not be just a fence post. You know, you have got to be there for these people. And I think that is the thing, biggest thing we have driven home, is that if there's a problem with anyone, yourself or anyone else, you need to open your mouth. You have to.
Yep, you can't be a bystander and you can't
no.
be an onlooker. You know, you have a responsibility as a human being to reach out and just lend a helping hand, whether it's making a phone call, whether it's talking to somebody or getting somebody help. If there's an issue like that at hand, then you've got to jump in and do something. It's, you know, it's someone's life that could be in the balance. And, you know, this is a real serious issue. Unfortunately, suicide has gotten to be at epidemic levels, not just here but worldwide, and it's getting worse. So I think that, you know, if you can reach out and just, if you save one person's life or say something that affects
right.
someone and makes them change their mind and makes them feel better about themselves, that's fabulous. You know, there's so much
mm-hmm.
negativity in the world, and you've got to counter that with positivity. I really believe that, and I've seen it, and I know it works. And all you have to do is talk to one person and say something, and they say something to someone else. And, you know, the movie Pay It Forward had a great concept, and it's if you do one nice thing for three people and not ask anything in return, and they go out and each of these three people do one nice thing for three more people, God, can you
right.
imagine what a great place this would be?
Absolutely.
It'd be incredible. I want to mention, by the way, that my book, Baderfield, How My Family Survived Suicide, is not only available on my website and on Amazon and on a myriad of sites if you look it up online, it's also available in the Apple iBook store. It's available on Kobo. It's available on the Nook, and it'll soon be available. There's another one. That's it. It's like 60 different worldwide digital markets. It can be downloaded instantaneously for like $7 or $8 instead of, you know, the hardcover, or it's a soft cover, but the printed version is about $16. But it's available, you know, instantly in so many different places. It's just to download. So I just
Great.
Wanted to throw that out there. And, you know, my website's carledavid.com. There are a lot of excerpts from the book and other things that are that I'm involved in my photography and my music and my art, obviously, too, because I am an art dealer.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us today, Carl. I really find that it's a very, very important topic. And, you know, as we have said and driven home, do not be, you know, a bystander with blinders on and let something happen around you. It's very, very important to get involved. So I'd like to thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, and I hope that anyone out there who's listening, who is not feeling great about themselves, goes and gets some help. Just make a phone call, talk to somebody, and don't quit. Don't give up. Life is beautiful, and you just have to fight for it. It's worth it, believe me.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us today. So to all my listeners, please do follow the show. And you will be able to find out what our next topic will be and when the next show will be. Thank you so much for being with us today. And this is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. My website is outofthebox healthcare.com. www.thebestofyourself.com if you need anything further. Thank you so much for being with us.